Zerchi sat on the floor in the midst of the litter and tried to massage the involuntary tremor out of his forearm, which had been recently electrified while exploring the autoscribe's intestinal regions. The muscular twitching reminded him of the galvanic response of a severed frog's leg. Since he had prudently remembered to disconnect the machine before tampering with it, he could only suppose that the fiend who invented the thing had provided it with facilities for electrocuting customers, even without power. While tweaking and tugging at connections in a search for loose wires, he had been assaulted by a high-voltage filter capacitor, which had taken advantage of an opportunity to discharge itself to ground through the person of the Reverend Father Abbot when Reverend Father's elbow brushed against the chassis. But Zerchi had no way of knowing whether he had fallen victim to a law of nature for filter capacitors, or to a cunningly devised booby trap aimed at discouraging customer tampering. Anyway, he had fallen. His posture on the floor had come about involuntarily. His only claim to competence at the repair of polylinguistic transcription devices lay in his proud record of once having extracted a dead mouse from the information storage circuitry, thereby correcting a mysterious tendency on the part of the machine to write double syllables. Dedubbable syllablesles. Having discovered no dead mice this time, he could feel for loose wires and hope heaven had granted him charismata as an electronic healer. But it was apparently not so. "Brother Patrick," he called toward the outer office, and climbed wearily to his feet. "Hey, Brother Pat!" he shouted again. Presently the door opened and his secretary waddled in, glanced at the open wall cabinets with their stupefying maze of computer circuitry, scanned the cluttered floor, then warily studied his spiritual ruler's expression.
"Shall I call the repair service again, Father Abbot?"
"Why bother?" Zerchi grunted. "You've called them 3 times. They've made 3 promises. We've waited 3 days. I need a stenographer, now! Preferably a Christian. That thing," he waved irritably toward the abominable autoscribe, "is a damned infidel or worse. Get rid of it. I want it out of here."
"The Aplac?"
"The Aplac. Sell it to an atheist. No, that wouldn't be kind. Sell it as junk. I'm through with it." Why, for heaven's sake, did Abbot Bomos, may his soul be blessed, ever buy the silly contraption?
"Well, Domine, they say your predecessor was fond of gadgets, and it is convenient to be able to write letters in languages you yourself can't speak."
"It is? You mean it would be? That contraption... Listen, brother, they claim it thinks. I didn't believe it at first. Thought, implying rational principle, implying soul. Can the principle of a thinking machine, man-made, be a rational soul? Bah! It seemed a thoroughly pagan notion at first. But you know what?"
"Father?"
"Nothing could be that perverse without premeditation. It must think. It knows good and evil, I tell you, and it chose the latter. Stop that snickering, will you? It's not funny. The notion isn't even pagan. Man made the contraption, but he didn't make its principle. They speak of the vegetative principle as a soul, don't they? A vegetable soul? And the animal soul? Then the rational human soul. And that's all they list in the way of incarnate vivifying principles, angels being disembodied. But how do we know the list is comprehensive? Vegetative, animative, rational. And then what else? That's what else, right there, that thing. And it fell. Get it out of here. But first I've got to get a radiogram off to Rome."
"Shall I get my pad, Reverend Father?"
"Do you speak Alleghenian?"
"No, I don't."
"Neither do I, and Cardinal Hofstroff doesn't speak Southwest."
"Why not Latin, then?"
"Which Latin? The Vulgate or modern? I don't trust my own Anglo-Latin, and if I did, he'd probably not trust his." He frowned at the bulk of the robotic stenographer. Brother Patrick frowned with him, then stepped over to the cabinets and began peering into the maze of sub-miniature circuit components. "No mouse," the abbot assured him.
"What are all these little knobs?"
"Don't touch!" Abbot Zerchi yelped, as his secretary curiously fingered one of several dozen sub-chassis dial settings. These sub-chassis controls were mounted in neat square array in a box, the cover of which the abbot had removed, bore the irresistible warning, "Factory adjustments only."
"You didn't move it, did you?"
he demanded, going to Patrick's side.
"I might have wiggled it a little, but I think it's back where it was."
Zerchi showed him the warning on the box's cover.
"Oh," said Pat,
and both of them stared.
"It's the punctuation, mostly, isn't it, Reverend Father?"
That and stray capitals and a few confused words. They contemplated the squiggles, quiggles, quids, thingumbobs, and doohickeyi in mystified silence. "Did you ever hear of the Venerable Francis of Utah?" the abbot asked at last.
"I don't recall the name, Domine. Why?"
"I was just hoping he's in a position to pray for us right now, although I don't believe he was ever canonized. Here, let's try turning this what's-us-up a bit."
"Brother Joshua used to be some kind of an engineer, I forget what, but he was in space. They have to know a lot about computers."
"I've already called him. He's afraid to touch it. Here, maybe it needs—" Patrick edged away.
"If you would excuse me, my lord, I—"
Zerchi glanced up at his wincing scribe. "Oh, ye of little faith," he said, correcting another factory adjustment.
"I thought I heard someone outside."
"Before the cock crows thrice. Besides, you touched the first knob, didn't you?" Patrick wilted.
"But the cover was off, and—"
"Hinc igitur effuge. Out, out, before I decide it was your fault."
Alone again, Zerchi inserted the wall plug, sat at his desk, and, after muttering a brief prayer to St. Leibowitz, who in recent centuries had come into wider popularity as the patron saint of electricians than he had ever won as the founder of the Albertian Order of St. Leibowitz, flipped the switch. He listened for spitting and hissing noises, but none came. He heard only the faint clicking of delay relays and the familiar purr of timing motors as they came up to full speed. He sniffed. No smoke or ozone to be detected. Finally, he opened his eyes. Even the indicator lights of the desktop control panel were burning as usual. Factory adjustments only, indeed. Somewhat reassured, he switched the format selector to radiogram, turned the process selector to dictate record, the translator unit to southwest in and Alleghenian out, made certain the transcription switch was on off, keyed his microphone button, and began dictating. "Priority urgent. To His Most Reverend Eminence, Sir Eric Cardinal Hofstrath, Vicar Apostolic Designate, Provisional Vicariat Extraterrestris, Sacred Congregation of Propaganda, Vatican, New Rome. Most Eminent Lord, in view of the recent renewal of world tensions, hints of a new international crisis, and even reports of a clandestine nuclear armaments race, we should be greatly honored if Your Eminence deems it prudent to counsel us concerning the present status of certain plans held in abeyance. I have reference to matters outlined in the motu proprio of Pope Celestine VIII, of happy memory, given on the Feast of the Divine Overshadowing of the Holy Virgin, Anno Domini 3735, and beginning with the words—" He paused to look through the papers on his desk. "Ab hoc planeta nativitatis, aliquos filios Ecclesia, usque ad planetas solium, alinorum iama bisse, numquam raditoros isse, intelligimus. Refer also to the confirming document of Anno Domini 3749, quo peregrinator grex pastor secum, authorizing the purchase of an island, certain vehicles. Lastly, refer to Casu belli nunc remoto, of the late Pope Paul, Anno Domini 3756, and the correspondence which followed between the Holy Father and my predecessor, culminating with an order transferring to us the task of holding the plan quo peregrinator in a state of suspended animation, but only so long as Your Eminence approves. Our state of readiness with respect to quo peregrinator has been maintained, and should it become desirable to execute the plan, we would need perhaps 6 weeks' notice." While the abbot dictated, the abominable autoscribe did no more than record his voice and translate it into a phoneme code on tape. After he had finished speaking, he switched the process selector to analyze and pressed a button marked text processing. The ready lamp winked off. The machine began processing. Meanwhile, Zerchi studied the documents before him. A chime sounded. The ready lamp winked on. The machine was silent. With only one nervous glance at the factory adjustment only box, the abbot closed his eyes and pressed the right button.
Clatterty-chat, clatter-spatter-pip-popperty-cack-fub-clutter.
The automatic writer chattered away at what he hoped would be the text of the radiogram. He listened hopefully to the rhythm of the keys. The first clatterty-chat, clatter-spatter-pip had sounded quite authoritative. He tried to hear the rhythms of Alleghenian speech in the sound of the typing. and after a time he decided that there was indeed a certain Allegheny lilt mixed into the rattle of the keys. He opened his eyes. Across the room, the robotic stenographer was briskly at work. He left his desk and went to watch it work. With utmost neatness, the abominable autoscribe was writing the Alleghenian equivalent of a mirror image of his dictation.
"Hey, Brother Pat!"
He turned off the machine in disgust.
"Holy Leibowitz! Did we labor for this?"
He could not see that it was any improvement over a carefully trimmed goose quill and a pot of mulberry ink.
"Hey, Pat!"
There was no immediate response from the outer office, but after a few seconds a monk with a red beard opened the door, and after glancing at the open cabinets, the littered floor, and the abbot's expression, he had the gall to smile.
"What's the matter, Magister Meus? Don't you like our modern technology?" "Not particularly, no," Zerchi snapped. "Hey, Pat!"
"He is out, my lord."
"Brother Joshua, can't you fix this thing? Really?"
"Really?
No, I can't. I've got to send a radiogram."
"That's too bad, Father Abbot. Can't do that either. They just took our crystal and padlocked the shack."
"They?"
"Zone Defense Interior. All private transmitters have been ordered off the air."
Zerchi wandered to his chair and sank into it.
"A defense alert? Why?"
Joshua shrugged.
"There's talk about an ultimatum. That's all I know, except what I hear from the radiation counters."
"Still rising?"
"Still rising."
"Call Spokane."
By mid-afternoon, the dusty wind had come. The wind came over the mesa and over the small city of San Leibowitz. It washed over the surrounding countryside, noisily through the tall corn in the irrigated fields, tearing streamers of blowing sand from the sterile ridges. It moaned about the stone walls of the ancient abbey and about the aluminum and glass walls of the modern additions to the abbey. It besmirched the reddening sun with the dirt of the land, and sent dust devils scurrying across the pavement of the six-lane highway that separated the ancient abbey from its modern additions. On the side road, which at one point flanked the highway and led from the monastery by way of a residential suburb into the city, an old beggar clad in burlap paused to listen to the wind. The wind brought the throb of practice rocketry explosively from the south. Ground-to-space interceptor missiles were being fired toward target orbits from a launching range far across the desert. The old man gazed at the faint red disk of the sun while he leaned on his staff and muttered to himself, or to the sun,
"Omens, omens."
A group of children were playing in the weed-filled yard of a hovel just across the side road, their games proceeding under the mute but all-seeing auspices of a gnarled black woman who smoked a weed-filled pipe on the porch and offered an occasional word of solace or remonstrance to one or another tearful player, who came as plaintiff before the grandmotherly court of her hovel porch. One of the children soon noticed the old tramp who stood across the roadway, and presently a shout went up.
Look it, it's old Lazar. Auntie say he be old Lazar. Same one at the Lord Jesus raise up. Look it, Lazar, Lazar.
The children thronged to the broken fence. The old tramp regarded them grumpily for a moment, then wandered on along the road. A pebble skipped across the ground at his feet.
Hey, Lazar! Auntie say, what the Lord Jesus raise up, it stay up. Look at him. Yeah, still hunting for the Lord, raise him. Auntie say...
Another rock skipped after the old man, but he did not look back. The old woman nodded sleepily. The children returned to their games. The dust storm thickened. Across the highway from the ancient abbey, atop one of the new aluminum and glass buildings, a monk on the roof was sampling the wind. He sampled it with a suction device, which ate the dusty air and blew the filtered wind to the intake of an air compressor on the floor below. The monk was no longer a youth, but not yet middle-aged. His short red beard seemed electrically charged, for it gathered pendant webs and streamers of dust. He scratched it irritably from time to time, and once he thrust his chin into the end of the suction hose. The result caused him to mutter explosively, then to cross himself. The compressor's motor coughed and died. The monk switched off the suction device, disconnected the blower hose, and pulled the device across the roof to the elevator and into the cage. Drifts of dust had settled in the corners. He closed the gate and pressed the down button. In the laboratory on the uppermost floor, he glanced at the compressor's gauge. It registered max norm. He closed the door, removed his habit, shook the dust out of it, hung it on a peg, and went over it with the suction device. Then, going to the deep sheet-steel sink at the end of the laboratory workbench, he turned on the cold water and let it rise to the 200-jug mark. Thrusting his head into the water, he washed the mud from his beard and hair. The effect was pleasantly icy. Dripping and sputtering, he glanced at the door. The likelihood of visitors, just now, seemed small. He removed his underwear, climbed into the tank, and settled back with a shivery sigh. Abruptly the door opened. Sister Helene came in with a tray of newly uncrated glassware. Startled, the monk leaped to his feet in the tub.
"Brother Joshua!"
the sister shrieked. Half a dozen beakers shattered on the floor. The monk sat down with a splash that sprayed the room. Sister Helene clucked, sputtered, squeaked, dumped the tray on the workbench, and fled. Joshua vaulted out of the sink and donned his habit without bothering to dry himself or put on his underwear. When he got to the door, Sister Helene was already out of the corridor, probably out of the building, and halfway to the sister's chapel just down the side lane. Mortified, he hastened to complete his labors. He emptied the suction device's contents and collected a sample of the dust in a vial. He took the vial to the workbench, plugged in a pair of headphones, and held the vial at a measured distance from the detector element of a radiation counter while he consulted his watch and listened. The compressor had a built-in counter. He pressed a stud marked Reset. The whirling decimal register flipped back to zero and began counting again. He stopped it after 1 minute and wrote the count on the back of his hand. It was mostly plain air, filtered and compressed, but there was a whiff of something else. He closed the lab for the afternoon. He went down to the office on the subjacent floor, wrote the count on a wall chart, eyed its perplexing upswing, then sat at his desk and flipped the viewphone switch. He dialed by feel while gazing at the telltale wall chart. The screen flashed, the phone beeped, and the viewer fluttered into focus on the back of an empty desk chair. After a few seconds, a man slid into the chair and peered into the viewer.
"Abbot Zerchi here," the abbot grunted. "Oh, Brother Joshua, I was about to call you. Have you been taking a bath?"
"Yes, my lord abbot."
"You might at least blush."
"I am."
"Well, it doesn't show up on the viewer. Listen, on this side of the highway, there's a sign just outside our gates. You've noticed it, of course. It says, 'Women beware, enter not lest,' and so forth. You've noticed it?"
"Surely, my lord."
"Take your oaths on this side of the sign."
"Certainly."
"Mortify yourself for offending sister's modesty. I'm aware that you haven't got any. Listen, I suppose you can't even bring yourself to pass the reservoir without jumping in, baby-spanking bald, for a swim."
"Who told you that, my lord? I mean, I've only waited."
"Yes? Well, never mind. Why did you call me?"
"You wanted me to call Spokane."
"Oh, yes. Did you?"
"Yes."
The monk gnawed at a bit of dry skin at the corner of his wind-cracked lips and paused uneasily.
"I talked to Father Leone. They've noticed it, too."
"The increased radiation count?"
"That's not all."
He hesitated again. He did not like saying it. To communicate a fact seemed always to lend it fuller existence.
"Well?"
"It's connected with that seismic disturbance a few days ago. It's carried by the upper winds from that direction. All things considered, it looks like fallout from a low-altitude burst in the megaton range."
"Phew!"
Zerchi sighed and covered his eyes with a hand.
"Luciferum ruice mihi dicis?"
"Yes, Domne. I'm afraid it was a weapon."
"Not possibly an industrial accident?"
"No."
"But if there were a war on, we'd know. An illicit test?"
"But not that either. If they wanted to test one, they could test it on the far side of the moon, or better, Mars, and not be caught." Joshua nodded.
"So what does that leave?" the abbot went on. "A display? A threat? A warning shot fired over the bow?"
"That's all I could think of."
"So that explains the defense alert. Still, there's nothing in the news except rumors and refusals to comment, and with dead silence from Asia."
"But the shot must have been reported from some of the observation satellites, unless, I don't like to suggest this, but unless somebody has discovered a way to shoot a space-to-Earth missile past the satellites without detection until it's on the target."
"Is that possible?"
"There has been some talk about it, Father Abbot."
"The government knows. The government must know. Several of them know. And yet we hear nothing. We are being protected from hysteria.
Isn't that what they call it? Maniacs. The world's been in a habitual state of crisis for 50 years. 50? What am I saying? It's been in a habitual state of crisis since the beginning, but for half a century now, almost unbearable. And why, for the love of God? What is the fundamental irritant, the essence of the tension? Political philosophies, economics, population pressure, disparity of culture and creed? Ask a dozen experts, get a dozen answers. Now, Lucifer again. Is the species congenitally insane, brother? If we're born mad, where's the hope of heaven? Through faith alone? Or isn't there any? God forgive me, I don't mean that. Listen, Joshua.
My lord?
As soon as you close up shop, come back over here. That radiogram, I had to send Brother Pat into town to get it translated and sent by regular wire. I want you around when the answer comes. Do you know what it's about? Brother Joshua shook his head. Quo peregrinator Grex. The monk slowly lost color.
To go into effect, Domine?
I'm just trying to learn the status of the plan. Don't mention it to anybody. Of course, you'll be affected. See me here when you're through.
Certainly.
Christe cum.
Cum spirituo.
The circuit opened. The screen faded. The room was warm, but Joshua shivered. He gazed out the window into a premature twilight murky with dust. He could see no farther than the storm fence next to the highway, where a passing procession of truck headlights made traveling halos in the dust haze. After a while, he became aware of someone standing near the gate where the driveway opened onto the turnpike approach. The figure was dimly visible in silhouette whenever the headlights aurorae flashed by in review. Joshua shivered again. The silhouette was unmistakably that of Mrs. Grails. No one else would have been recognizable in such poor visibility, but the shape of the hooded bundle on her left shoulder and the way her head tilted toward the right made her outline uniquely that of old Ma'am Grails. The monk pulled curtains across the window and turned on the light. He was not repelled by the old woman's deformity. The world had grown blasé about such genetic mishaps and pranks of the genes. His own left hand still bore a tiny scar, where a sixth finger had been removed during his infancy. But the heritage of the Diluvium Ignis was something he preferred to forget for the moment, and Mrs. Grails was one of its more conspicuous heirs. He fingered a globe of the world on his desk. He spun it so that the Pacific Ocean and East Asia drifted past. Where? Precisely where? He twirled the globe faster, slapping it lightly again and again, so that the world spun like a gaming wheel, faster and yet faster, until the continents and oceans became a blur. Place your bets, sir and madam. Where? He braked the globe abruptly with his thumb. Bank. India pays off. Please collect, madam. The divination was wild. He spun the globe again until the axial mountings rattled. Days flitted by as briefest instants. In a reverse sense, he noticed suddenly. If Mother Gaia pirouetted in the same sense, the sun and other passing scenery would rise in the west and set in the east, reversing time thereby. Said the namesake of my namesake, move not, O sun, toward Gabaon, nor thou, O moon, toward the valley. A neat trick, forsooth, and useful in these times, too. Back up, O sun, et tu, luna, recedite in orbitas reversas. He kept spinning the globe in reverse, as if hoping the simulacrum of Earth possessed the chronos for unwinding time. A third of a million turns might unwind enough days to carry it back to the Diluvium Ignis. Better to use a motor and spin it back to the beginning of man. He stopped it again with his thumb. Once more, the divination was wild. Still, he lingered in the office and dreaded going home again. Home was only across the highway, in the haunted halls of those ancient buildings whose walls still contained stones which had been the rubbled concrete of a civilization that had died 18 centuries ago. Crossing the highway to the old abbey was like crossing an eon. Here in the new aluminum and glass buildings, he was a technician at a workbench where events were only phenomena, to be observed with regard for their how, not questioning their why. On this side of the road, the falling of Lucifer was only an inference derived by cold arithmetic from the chatter of radiation counters, from the sudden swing of a seismograph pen. But in the old abbey, he ceased to be a technician. Over there, he was a monk of Christ, a booklegger and memorizer in the community of Leibowitz. Over there, the question would be, why, Lord, why? But the question had already come, and the abbot had said, "See me." Joshua reached for his bindlestiff and went to obey the summons of his ruler. To avoid meeting Mrs. Grayles, he used the pedestrian underpass. It was no time for pleasant conversations with the bicephalous old tomato woman. 25. The dike of secrecy had broken. Several dauntless Dutch boys were swept away by the raging tide. The tide swept them right out of Texarkana to their country estates, where they became unavailable for comment. Others remained at their posts and staunchly tried to plug new leaks. But the fall of certain isotopes in the wind created a universal byword, spoken on street corners and screamed by banner headlines. Lucifer is fallen. The Minister of Defense, his uniform immaculate, his makeup unsmeared, and his equanimity unruffled, again faced the journalistic fraternity. This time, the press conference was televised throughout the Christian coalition. Lady Reporter,
"Your Lordship appears rather calm in the face of the facts. Two violations of international law, both defined by treaty as warlike acts, have recently occurred. Doesn't that worry the War Ministry at all?"
Defense Minister, "Madam, as you very well know, we do not have a war ministry here. We have a defense ministry. And as far as I know, only one violation of international law has occurred. Would you mind acquainting me with the other?" Lady Reporter,
"Which one are you not acquainted with? The disaster in Itaewon, or the warning shot over the far South Pacific?"
Defense Minister, suddenly stern,
"Surely Madam intends nothing seditious. But your question seems to give comfort, if not credence, to the utterly false Asian charges that the so-called Itaewon disaster was the result of a weapon test by us, and not by them."
Lady Reporter,
"If it does, I invite you to throw me in jail. The question was based on a Near East neutralist account, which reported that the Itaewon disaster was the result of an Asian weapon test, underground, which broke free. The same account said that the Itaewon test was sighted from our satellites and immediately answered by a space-to-Earth warning shot southeast of New Zealand. But now that you suggest it, was the Itaewon disaster also the result of a weapon test by us?"
Defense Minister, with forced patience,
"I recognize the journalistic requirement of objectivity, but to suggest that His Supremacy's government would deliberately violate..."
Lady Reporter,
"His Supremacy is an 11-year-old boy, and to call it his government is not only archaic, but a highly dishonorable, even cheap attempt to shift the responsibility for a full denial from your own..."
Moderator,
"Madam, please restrain the tenor of your..."
Defense Minister,
"Overlook it, overlook it. Madam, you have my full denial, if you must dignify the fantastic charges. The so-called Itaewon disaster was not the result of a weapon test by us. Nor do I have any knowledge of any other recent nuclear detonation."
Lady Reporter,
"Thank you."
Moderator,
"I believe the editor of the Texarkana Star Insight has been trying to speak."
Editor,
"Thank you. I should like to ask your lordship, what did happen in Itaewon?"
Defense Minister,
"We have no nationals in that area. We have had no observers there since diplomatic relations were broken during the last world crisis. I can, therefore, only rely upon indirect evidence and the somewhat conflicting neutralist accounts."
Editor,
"That is to be understood."
Defense Minister,
"Very well, then. I gather there was a subsurface nuclear detonation in the megaton range, and it got out of hand. It was rather obviously a test of some sort. Whether it was a weapon, or, as some Asia fringe neutrals claim, an attempt to divert an underground river, it was clearly illegal, and adjoining countries are preparing a protest to the World Court."
Editor,
"Is there any risk of war?"
Defense Minister,
"I foresee none. But as you know, we have certain detachments of our armed forces, which are subject to conscription by the World Court to enforce its decisions, if needed. I foresee no such need, but I cannot speak for the court."
First Reporter,
"But the Asian coalition has threatened an immediate all-out strike against our space installations if the court does not take action against us. What if the court is slow in acting?"
Defense Minister,
"No ultimatum has been delivered. The threat was for Asian home consumption, as I see it, to cover their blunder in Itaewon."
Lady Reporter,
"How is your abiding faith in motherhood today, Lord Regale?"
Defense Minister,
"I hope motherhood is at least as much abiding faith in me as I have in motherhood.
Lady Reporter.
You deserve at least that much, I'm sure.
The news conference, radiated from the relay satellite 22,000 miles from Earth, bathed most of the Western Hemisphere with a flickering VHF signal, which carried such intelligence to the panelescent wall screens of the multitudes. One among the multitudes, Abbot Domzerchi, switched off the set. He paced for a while, waiting for Joshua, trying not to think. But not thinking proved impossible. Listen, are we helpless? Are we doomed to do it again and again and again? Have we no choice but to play the Phoenix in an unending sequence of rise and fall? Assyria, Babylon, Egypt, Greece, Carthage, Rome, the empires of Charlemagne and the Turk, ground to dust and plowed with salt. Spain, France, Britain, America, burned into the oblivion of the centuries. And again, and again, and again. Are we doomed to it, Lord? Chained to the pendulum of our own mad clockwork? Helpless to halt its swing? This time it will swing us clean to oblivion, he thought. The feeling of desperation passed abruptly when Brother Pat brought him the second telegram. The abbot ripped it open, read it at a glance, and chuckled. Brother Joshua here yet, brother?
Waiting outside, Reverend Father.
Send him in. Oh, brother, shut the door and turn on the silencer. Then read this. Joshua glanced at the first telegram.
An answer from New Rome?
It came this morning, but turn on that silencer first. We've got things to discuss. Joshua closed the door and flipped a wall switch. Concealed loudspeakers squealed a brief protest. When the squealing stopped, the room's acoustic properties seemed suddenly changed. Domzerchi waved him toward a chair, and he read the first telegram in silence.
No action whatever to be taken by you in connection with Quo Peregrinator Grex, he read aloud.
You'll have to shout with that thing on, said the abbot, indicating the silencer. What?
I was just reading. So the plan is cancelled?
Don't look so relieved. That came this morning. This came this afternoon. The abbot tossed him the second telegram.
Ignore earlier message of this date. Quo Peregrinator to be reactivated immediately by request of Holy Father. Prepare cadre to leave within 3 days. Wait for confirming wire before departure. Report any vacancies in cadre organization. Begin conditional implementation of plan. Eric Cardinal Hofstraff, Vicar Apostolic, Extrater Provinciae.
The monk's face lost color. He replaced the telegram on the desk and sat back in his chair, lips tight together.
You know what Quo Peregrinator is? I know what it is, Domine, but not in detail.
Well, it started as a plan to send a few priests along with a colony group headed for Alpha Centauri, but that didn't work out because it takes bishops to ordain priests, and after the first generation of colonists, more priests would have to be sent, and so on. The question boiled down to an argument about whether the colonies would last, and if so, should provision be made to ensure the apostolic succession on colony planets without recourse to Earth. You know what that would mean.
Sending at least 3 bishops, I imagine.
Yes, and that seemed a little silly. The colony groups have all been rather small. But during the last world crisis, Quo Peregrinator became an emergency plan for perpetuating the church on the colony planets, if the worst came to pass on Earth. We have a ship.
A starship?
No less. And we have a crew capable of managing it.
Where?
We have the crew right here.
Here at the Abbey? But who?
Joshua stopped. His face grew even grayer than before.
But, Domine, my experience in space has been entirely in orbital vehicles, not in starships. Before Nancy died and I went to the Cistercian...
I know all about that. There are others with starship experience. You know who they are. There are even jokes about the number of ex-spacers that seem to feel a vocation to our order. It's no accident, of course. And you remember when you were a postulant, how you were quizzed about your experience in space? Joshua nodded. You must also remember being asked about your willingness to go to space again, if the order asked it of you.
Yes.
Then you were not wholly unaware that you were conditionally assigned to Quo Peregrinator, if it ever came to pass.
I guess I was afraid it was so, my lord.
Afraid?
Suspected, rather. Afraid, too, a little, because I've always hoped to spend the rest of my life in the order.
As a priest?
That Well, I haven't yet decided.
Quo peregrinatur will not involve releasing you from your vows, or mean abandoning the order.
The order goes too?
Zerchi smiled. And the memorabilia with it.
The whole kit and... Oh, you mean on microfilm. Where to?
The Centaurus colony.
How long would we be gone, Domne?
If you go, you'll never come back. The monk breathed heavily and stared at the second telegram without seeming to see it. He scratched his beard and appeared bemused. 3 questions, said the abbot. Don't answer now, but start thinking about them, and think hard. First, are you willing to go? Second, do you have a vocation to the priesthood? Third, are you willing to lead the group? And by willing, I don't mean willing under obedience. I mean enthusiastic, or willing to get that way. Think it over. You have 3 days to think. Maybe less. Modern change had made but few incursions upon the buildings and the grounds of the ancient monastery. To protect the old buildings against the encroachment of a more impatient architecture, new additions had been made outside the walls, and even across the highway, sometimes at the expense of convenience. The old refectory had been condemned because of a buckling roof, and it was necessary to cross the highway in order to reach the new refectory. The inconvenience was somewhat mitigated by the culvert walk-under through which the brothers marched daily to meals. Centuries old, but recently widened, the highway was the same road used by pagan armies, pilgrims, peasants, donkey carts, nomads, wild horsemen out of the east, artillery, tanks, and 10-ton trucks. Its traffic had gushed or trickled or dripped, according to the age and season. Once before, long ago, there had been 6 lanes and robot traffic. Then the traffic had stopped, the paving had cracked, and sparse grass grew in the cracks after an occasional rain. Dust had covered it. Desert dwellers had dug up its broken concrete for the building of hovels and barricades. Erosion made it a desert trail, crossing wilderness. But now, there were 6 lanes and robot traffic, as before. "Traffic's light tonight," the abbot observed, as they left the old main gate. "Let's hike across. That tunnel can be suffocating after a dust storm. Or don't you feel like dodging buses?"
"Let's go," Brother Joshua agreed.
Low-slung trucks with feeble headlights, useful only for warning purposes, sped mindlessly past them with whining tires and moaning turbines. With dish antennae they watched the road, and with magnetic feelers they felt at the guiding strips of steel in the roadbed, and were given guidance thereby, as they rushed along the pink, fluorescent river of oiled concrete. Economic corpuscles and an artery of man, the behemoths charged heedlessly past the 2 monks, who dodged them from lane to lane. To be felled by one of them was to be run over by truck after truck until a safety cruiser found the flattened imprint of a man on the pavement and stopped to clean it up. The autopilot's sensing mechanisms were better at detecting masses of metal than masses of flesh and bone.
"This was a mistake," Joshua said,
as they reached the center island and paused for breath.
"Look who's standing over there."
The abbot peered for a moment, then clapped his forehead.
"Mrs. Grails! I clean forgot. It's her night to prowl me down. She sold her tomatoes to the sisters' refectory, and now she's after me again."
"After you? She was there last night and the night before, too. I thought she was waiting for a ride. What does she want from you?"
"Oh, nothing, really. She's finished jipping the sisters on the price of tomatoes, and now she'll donate the surplus profit to me for the poor box. It's a little ritual. I don't mind the ritual. It's what comes afterward that's bad. You'll see."
"Shall we go back?"
"And hurt her feelings? Nonsense. She's seen us by now. Come on."
They plunged into the thin stream of trucks again. The 2-headed woman and her 6-legged dog waited with an empty vegetable basket by the new gate. The woman crooned softly to the dog. 4 of the dog's legs were healthy legs, but an extra pair dangled uselessly at its sides. As for the woman, 1 head was as useless as the extra legs of the dog. It was a small head, a cherubic head, but it never opened its eyes. It gave no evidence of sharing in her breathing or her understanding. It lolled uselessly on 1 shoulder, blind, deaf, mute, and only vegetatively alive. Perhaps it lacked a brain, for it showed no sign of independent consciousness or personality. Her other face had aged, grown wrinkled, but the superfluous head retained the features of infancy. although it had been toughened by the gritty wind and darkened by the desert sun. The old woman curtsied at their approach, and her dog drew back with a snarl.
"Evening, Father Zirchi," she drawled. "A most pleasant evening to you, and to your brother."
"Why, hello, Mrs. Grails." The dog barked, bristled, and began a frenzied dance, feinting toward the abbot's ankles with fangs bared for slashing. Mrs. Grails promptly struck her pet with the vegetable basket. The dog's teeth slashed the basket. The dog turned on its mistress. Mrs. Grails kept it away with the basket, and after receiving a few resounding whacks, the dog retired to sit growling in the gateway. "What a fine mood Priscilla's in," Zerchi observed pleasantly. "Is she going to have pups?"
"Beg shravness, your honors," said Mrs. Grails. "But's not the pup's motherful condition as makes her so, devil fretter. But 'tis that man of mine. He's witched the piteous pup he has, for love of witching, and it makes her feared of all. I beg your honor's shravness for her naughties."
"It's all right. Well, good night, Mrs. Grails." But escape proved not that easy. She caught at the abbot's sleeve and smiled her toothlessly irresistible smile.
"A minute, father. Only a minute for an old tomato woman, if you have it to spare."
"Why, of course. I'd be glad." Joshua gave the abbot a sidelong grin and went over to negotiate with the dog concerning right of way. Priscilla eyed him with plain contempt.
"Here, father, here,"
Mrs. Grails was saying.
"Take a little something for your box. Here."
Coins rattled while Zerchi protested.
"No, here, take of it," she insisted. "Oh, I know, as how you always say, by fret, but I be not so poor as you might think on me, and ye do good work. If ye don't take it, that no good man of mine will have it from me, and do him the devil's work. Here, I sold my tomatoes, and I got my price near, and I bought my feed for the week, and even a play pretty for Rachel. I want ye to have of it. Here."
"It's very kind." Came an authoritative bark from the gateway.
Ruff, ruff, ruff,
followed by a rapid sequence of yaps, yeeps, and Priscilla's howling in full retreat. Joshua came wandering back with his hands in his sleeves.
"Are you wounded, man?"
"Ruff,"
said the monk. "What on earth did you do to her?"
"Ruff,"
Brother Joshua repeated.
"Ruff, ruff, ruff,"
then explained.
"Priscilla believes in werewolves. The yelping was hers. We can get past the gate now."
The dog had vanished, but again Mrs. Grails caught at the abbot's sleeve.
"Only a minute more of your father, and I'll keep you no longer. It's little Rachel I wanted to see you about. There's the baptism and the christening to be thought of, and I wish to ask you if ye'd do the honor of—"
"Mrs. Grails," he put in gently, "go see your own parish priest. He should handle these matters, not I. I have no parish, only the abbey. Talk to Father Silo at St. Michael's. Our church doesn't even have a font. Women aren't permitted, except in the tribune."
"The sisters' chapel has a font, and women can—"
"It's for Father Silo, not for me. It has to be recorded in your own parish. Only as an emergency could I—"
Ah, that I know. But I saw Father Silo. I brought Rachel to his church, and the fool of a man would not touch her."
"He refused to baptize Rachel?"
"That he did, the fool of a man."
"It's a priest you're talking of, Mrs. Grails, and no fool, for I know him well. He must have his reasons for refusing. If you don't agree with his reasons, then see someone else, but not a monastic priest. Talk to the pastor at St. Maisie's, perhaps."
"Ah, and that too I have done."
She launched into what promised to be a prolonged account of her skirmishings on behalf of the unbaptized Rachel. The monks listened patiently at first, but while Joshua was watching her, he seized the abbot's arm above the elbow. His fingers gradually dug into Zerchi's arm until the abbot winced in pain and tore the fingers away with his free hand.
"What are you doing?"
he whispered, but then noticed the monk's expression. Joshua's eyes were fixed on the old woman as if she were a cockatrice. Zerchi followed his gaze, but saw nothing stranger than usual. Her extra head was half concealed by a sort of veil, but Brother Joshua had certainly seen that often enough. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Grails," Zerchi interrupted as soon as she fell short of breath. "I really must go now. I'll tell you what. I'll call Father Silo for you, but that's all I can do. We'll see you again, I'm sure."
"Thank you kindly, and I beg your shriveness for keeping you,"
Good night, Mrs. Grails. They entered the gate and walked toward the refectory. Joshua thumped the heel of his hand against his temple several times, as if to jar something back into place. "Why were you staring at her like that?" the abbot demanded. "I thought it rude."
"Didn't you notice?"
"Notice what?"
"Then you didn't notice. Well, let it pass. But who is Rachel? Why won't they baptize the child? Is she the woman's daughter?"
The abbot smiled without humor. "That's what Mrs. Grails contends, but there's some question as to whether Rachel is her daughter, her sister, or merely an excrescence growing out of her shoulder."
"Rachel? Her other head?"
"Don't shout so. She'll hear you yet."
"And she wants it baptized?"
"Rather urgently, wouldn't you say? It seems to be an obsession." Joshua waved his arms.
"How do they settle such things?"
"I don't know, and I don't want to know. I'm grateful to heaven that it's not up to me to figure it out. If it were a simple case of Siamese twins, it would be easy. But it isn't. The old-timers say Rachel wasn't there when Mrs. Grails was born."
"A farmer's fable."
"Perhaps. But some are willing to tell it under oath. How many souls has an old lady with an extra head? A head that just grew? Things like that cause ulcers in high places, my son. Now, what was it you noticed? Why were you staring at her and trying to pinch my arm off like that?" The monk was slow to answer.
"It smiled at me," he said at last.
"What smiled?"
"Her extra, Rachel. She smiled. I thought she was going to wake up."
The abbot stopped him in the refectory's entranceway and peered at him curiously.
"She smiled,"
the monk repeated very earnestly.
"You imagined it?"
"Yes, my lord."
"Then look like you imagined it."
Brother Joshua tried.
"I can't," he admitted.
The abbot dropped the old woman's coins in the poor box.
"Let's go on inside," he said.
The new refectory was functional, chromium befixtured, acoustically tailored, and germicidally illuminated. Gone were the smoke-blackened stones, the tallow lamps, the wooden bowls and cellar-ripened cheeses. Except for the cruciform seating arrangement and a rank of images along one wall, the place resembled an industrial lunchroom. Its atmosphere had changed, as had the atmosphere of the entire abbey. After ages of striving to preserve remnants of culture from a civilization long dead, the monks had watched the rise of a new and mightier civilization. The old tasks had been completed. New ones were found. The past was venerated and exhibited in glass cases, but it was no longer the present. The order conformed to the times, to an age of uranium and steel and flaring rocketry, amid the growl of heavy industry and the high thin whine of star drive converters. The order conformed, at least in superficial ways.
"Accedite ad eum," the reader intoned.
The robed legions stood restlessly at their places during the reading. No food had yet appeared. The tables were bare of dishes. Supper had been deferred. The organism, the community, whose cells were men, whose life had flowed through 70 generations, seemed tense tonight, seemed to sense a note amiss tonight, seemed aware, through the connaturality of its membership, of what had been told to only a few. The organism lived as a body, worshipped and worked as a body, and at times seemed dimly conscious as a mind that infused its members and whispered to itself, and to another, in the lingua prima, baby tongue of the species. Perhaps the tension was increased as much by faint snort growl of practice rocketry from the distant anti-missile range as by the unexpected postponement of the meal. The abbot rapped for silence, then gestured his prior, Father Leahy, toward the lectern. The prior looked pained for a moment before speaking.
"We all regret the necessity," he said at last, "of sometimes disturbing the quiet of contemplative life with news from the outside world. But we must remember, too, that we are here to pray for the world and its salvation, as for our own. Especially now, the world could use some praying for."
He paused to glance at Zerchi. The abbot nodded.
"Lucifer is fallen," said the priest,
and stopped. He stood there looking down at the lectern as if suddenly struck dumb. Zerchi arose.
"That is Brother Joshua's inference, by the way," he interposed. "The Regency Council of the Atlantic Confederacy has said nothing to speak of.
The dynasty has issued no statements. We know little more than we knew yesterday, except that the World Court is meeting in emergency session, and that the Defense Interior people are moving fast. There is a defense alert, and will be affected, but don't be disturbed. Father?
Thank you, Domne, said the prior, seeming to regain his voice as Domzerchi was seated again. Now, Reverend Father Abbott asked me to make the following announcements. First, for the next 3 days we shall sing the little office of Our Lady before Matins, asking her intercession for peace. Second, general instructions for civil defense in the event of a space strike or missile attack alert are available on the table by the entrance. Everybody take one. If you've read it, read it again. Third, in the event that an attack warning is sounded, the following brothers are to report immediately to Old Abbey Courtyard for special instructions. If no attack warning comes, the same brothers will report there anyway day after tomorrow morning, right after Matins and Lauds. Names, brothers Joshua, Christopher, Augustine, James, Samuel.
The monks listened with quiet tension, betraying no emotion. There were 27 names in all, but no novices were among them. Some were eminent scholars. There were a janitor and a cook as well. At first hearing, one might assume that the names had been drawn from a box. By the time Father Leahy had finished the list, some of the brothers were eyeing each other curiously.
And this same group will report to the dispensary for a complete physical examination tomorrow after prime,
the prior finished. He turned to look questioningly at Domzerchi.
Domne?
Yes, just one thing, said the abbot, approaching the lectern. Brothers, let us not assume that there is going to be war. Let's remind ourselves that Lucifer has been with us, this time for nearly 2 centuries, and was dropped only twice, in sizes smaller than Megaton. We all know what could happen if there's war. The genetic festering is still with us from the last time man tried to eradicate himself. Back then, in the St. Leibowitz's time, maybe they didn't know what would happen. Or perhaps they did know, but could not quite believe it until they tried it. Like a child who knows what a loaded pistol is supposed to do, but who never pulled a trigger before. They had not yet seen 1 billion corpses. They had not seen the stillborn, the monstrous, the dehumanized, the blind. They had not yet seen the madness and the murder and the blotting out of reason. Then they did it, and then they saw it. Now, the princes, the presidents, the presidiums, now they know with dead certainty. They can know it by the children they beget and send to asylums for the deformed. They know it, and they've kept the peace. Not Christ's peace, certainly, but peace, until lately, with only 2 warlike incidents in as many centuries. Now they have the bitter certainty. My sons, they cannot do it again. Only a race of madmen could do it again. He stopped speaking. Someone was smiling. It was only a small smile, but in the midst of a sea of grave faces, it stood out like a dead fly in a bowl of cream. Domzerchi frowned. The old man kept on smiling, wryly. He sat at the beggar's table with 3 other transient tramps. An old fellow with a brushy beard, stained yellow about the chin. As a jacket, he wore a burlap bag with armholes. He continued to smile at Zerchi. He looked old as a rain-worn crag, and a suitable candidate for a Maundy laving. Zerchi wondered if he were about to stand up and make an announcement to his hosts. Or blow a ram's horn at them, perhaps? But that was only an illusion generated by the smile. He quickly dismissed the feeling that he had seen the old man before somewhere. He concluded his remarks. On his way back to his place, he paused. The beggar nodded pleasantly at his host. Zerchi came nearer. "Who are you, if I may ask? Have I seen you somewhere before?"
"Latsar Shemi."
"What?"
"Latsar Shemi,"
the beggar repeated.
"I don't quite—"
"Call me Lazarus, then,"
said the old one, and chuckled. Domzerchi shook his head and moved on. Lazarus? There was in the region an old wives' tale to the effect that— But what a shoddy sort of myth that was. Raised up by Christ, but still not a Christian, they said. And yet he could not escape the feeling that he had seen the old man somewhere. "Let the bread be brought for blessing," he called, and the deferment of supper was at an end. After the prayers, the abbot glanced toward the beggar's table again. The old man was merely fanning his soup with a sort of basket hat. Cerchi dismissed it with a shrug, and the meal began in solemn silence. Compline, the church's night prayer, seemed especially profound that night. But Joshua slept badly afterwards. In a dream he met Mrs. Grails again. There was a surgeon who sharpened a knife, saying, "This deformity must be removed before it becomes malignant." And the Rachel face opened its eyes and tried to speak to Joshua, but he could hear her only faintly, and to understand her, not at all.
"Accurate am I the exception," she seemed to be saying. "I commensurate the deception. Am."
He could make nothing of it, but he tried to reach through to save her. There seemed to be a rubbery wall of glass in the way. He paused and tried to read her lips. "I am the... I am the..."
"I am the Immaculate Conception," came the dream whisper.
He tried to tear his way through the rubbery glass to save her from the knife, but it was too late, and there was a great deal of blood afterwards. He awoke from the blasphemous nightmare with a shudder and prayed for a time, but as soon as he slept, there was Mrs. Grails again. It was a troubled night, a night that belonged to Lucifer. It was the night of the Atlantic assault against the Asian space installations. In swift retaliation, an ancient city died. 26.
"This is your emergency warning network," the announcer was saying when Joshua entered the abbot's study after matins of the following day, "bringing you the latest bulletin on the pattern of fallout from the enemy missile assault on Texarkana."
"You sent for me, Domine?"
Zerchi waved him to silence and toward his seat. The priest's face looked drawn and bloodless, a steel-gray mask of icy self-control. To Joshua, he seemed to have shrunk in size, to have aged since nightfall. They listened gloomily to the voice which waxed and waned at four-second intervals as the broadcasting stations were switched on and off the air as an impediment to enemy direction-finding equipment.
"But first, an announcement just released by the Supreme Command. The royal family is safe. I repeat, the royal family is known to be safe. The Regency Council is said to have been absent from the city when the enemy struck. Outside of the disaster area, no civil disorders have been reported, and none is expected. A ceasefire order has been issued by the World Court of Nations with a suspended proscription involving the death sentence against the responsible heads of government of both nations. Being suspended, the sentence becomes applicable only if the decree is disobeyed. Both governments cable to the court their immediate acknowledgement of the order, and there is, therefore, a strong probability that the clash is at an end, a few hours after it began, as a preventative assault against certain illegal space installations. In a surprise attack, the space forces of the Atlantic Confederacy last night struck at three concealed Asian missile sites located on the far side of the moon, and totally destroyed one enemy space station known to be involved in a guidance system for space-to-Earth missiles. It was expected that the enemy would retaliate against our forces in space, but the barbarous assault on our capital city was an act of desperation which no one anticipated. Special Bulletin. Our government has just announced its intention to honor the ceasefire for 10 days if the enemy agrees to an immediate meeting of foreign ministers and military commanders on Guam. The enemy is expected to accept."
10 days, the abbot groaned. "It doesn't give us enough time."
"The Asian radio, however, is still insisting that the recent thermonuclear disaster in Itaewon, causing some 80,000 casualties, was the work of an errant Atlantic missile, and the destruction of the city of Texarkana was therefore retaliation in kind."
The abbot snapped off the set. "Where's the truth?" he asked quietly. "What's to be believed? What does it matter at all? When mass murder has been answered with mass murder, rape with rape, hate with hate, there's no longer much meaning in asking whose axe is the bloodier. Evil on evil, piled on evil. Was there any justification in our police action in space? How can we know? Certainly there was no justification for what they did. Or was there? We only know what that thing says, and that thing is a captive. The Asian radio has to say what will least displease its government. Ours has to say what will least displease our fine, patriotic, opinionated rabble, which is what, coincidentally, the government wants it to say anyhow, so where's the difference? Dear God, there must be 500,000 dead if they hit Texarkana with the real thing. I feel like saying words I've never even heard.
toad's dung, hag pus, gangrene of the soul, immortal brain rot. Do you understand me, brother? And Christ breathed the same carrion air with